Suited, booted, paranoid, punk poet, Salford surrealist, new wave George Formby, rock and roll Betjeman, a Coronation Street Jack Kerouac, a bebop Albert Tatlock, a Lancastrian Baudelaire, Manchester modernist, Joycean delinquent, junkie, wired clown, pun-slinging outlaw, dandy Highway 61 Bob Dylan as a Northern Club comedian, an L.S. Lowry stickman in dark shades on the run from the everyday. Here's Johnny, John Cooper Clark, the man Frank Zappa said had exquisite diction, the man who put the speed, the north, the freakish, the nerve, the smoke, the polished Chelsea boot into poetry.
He watched the snooker tournament, and then he exed his mum with a poker work ornament, declaring slum sweet slum. Hit her round the ear hole, no mean feat. That's the stuff of heroes overnight on Beasley Street.
The 27-year-old John turned up in 1976 Manchester as a punk poet in tight mod clothes and sunglasses with a ton of colourful words about bleak, farcical northern life. Two incendiary visits by London punk pioneers the Sex Pistols in the summer of 76 had an enormous impact on a tired, sooty city, disconnected from its own radical history, battered by the war and seemingly in permanent post-industrial decline.
God save the Queen!
We talked to John outside the venue where the Sex Pistols played.
We're outside the Radisson Ed Warren Hotel, John. And of course originally this was the Free Trade Hall, stroke lesser Free Trade Hall. A lot of buildings in Manchester seem to have just disappeared.
That's right. Well, this one hasn't disappeared in a building, but its function has changed. This played host to all the major concerts in the up until the 80s, really, I think, didn't it?
Yeah.
Bob Dylan, Van Morrison, people,
Bowie, Pink
David
Floyd,
Bowie, Pink yeah. Floyd, the two concerts from the by the Sex Pistols
yeah.
in 1976.
The noise, attitude and black humour of the Pistols inspired bored, anxious young local musicians to form their own groups and make music that sounded like it was from Manchester, not London or Los Angeles or the dark side of the moon. When John popped up at local punk shows, rapidly reading bitter, berserk poems that instantly fitted in with what was going on, he seemed to have come from nowhere.
John, can we go back to the very beginning? I'm very interested in your first sightings, if you like, of poetry and what actually got you interested in poetry in the very beginning.
School, I guess. It was a Salford slum school, you know. We had to go to another school to do woodwork. Put it this way, we had our own coroner. And we would have to write essays with titles like What I Wanna Be If I Grow Up. But even given that, nobody left that place unable to read.
You're like a dose of scabies. I've got you under my skin. You make life a fairy tale. Grim. People.
Before punk gave John's act just the right audience and setting, he found other places where it didn't seem odd for an eccentrically clad outsider to read poems with a combative tone that crackled with vernacular wit. Sat in a Salford pub near where John would have performed, cultural historian at Salford University, C.P. Lee, remembers spotting John lurking a little suspiciously well before punk took hold.
I would have first seen John in folk clubs in the late 1960s. The folk club back in those days was a meeting place where you would get poets, you would get storytellers, raconteurs, as well as musicians. They provided a platform that was denied to them in the beat club environment, where you had to play an instrument and be in a band and make music.
Like the shadow of the guillotine on a dead consumptive's face.
Were you actually at the Lesser Free Trade Hall for one of the Pistols?
I was one of that 5 million people in that little room. Obviously, I'd read the review in the NME of their St. Martin's Art College gig, where they assaulted the audience and all that, and there was a picture of Johnny, like, I thought he was Johnny Ray. He was very similar looking in a way, you know. It was Johnny Rotten. I thought, well, what a face, you know. It looked like Johnny Ray in, having an argument with somebody.
Punk shoved John and old cobble smoke stained Manchester into the future. The Sex Pistols shows were organised by Howard Devoto, a brainy fan of Iggy Pop and Dostoevsky, who formed the Buzzcocks. Almost all the audience would go on to form their own groups, such as The Fall, Joy Division, Magazine and The Smiths, groups with their own volatile northern way with words. John, one nervy, thin man, and his explosive, cluttered imagination would be their deviant warm-up man. Pete Shelley, guitarist with the Buzzcocks.
Because Manchester always had this thread of, like, poets and, like, comedians would be doing things, you know, sort of, but more folk events.
Yes.
But he then made that, because he made that transition out of that, which would be his, seems to be his natural thing, into again a whole new audience. So it wasn't like all the old jazzers smoking pipes who's doing it. It was, you know, the young kids and us.
And us.
John, an unorthodox revolutionary, saw a connection he relished between punk and surrealism. Punk was a way for individuals with new experimental ideas about music, art, politics and entertainment to be seen and heard and create busy, enterprising new communities. DJ and filmmaker Don Letts was a key part of the London scene, and he was there to see John Cooper Clarke perform with groups such as The Clash, Susie and the Banshees and The Pistols themselves.
The punk attitude wasn't about mohawks and safety pins. It was about exactly that, the attitude. So you could have these really interesting lineups that included John Cooper Clarke, a reggae act like Steel Pulse and The Slips, and like I said, myself DJing on disc.
Round the block against the clock, tick-tock, 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 tick-tock. Running out of breath, running out of socks. Rubber on the road, flippity-flop. Non-skid agility, chop-chop, no time to hang about. Workout, El Fanatic, workout.
A punk rock gig could be like a Dada variety show, because the point was to break away from the ordinary and the routine, and this was both in the spirit of anarchy and also in the spirit of the music hall. C.P. Lee again.
Richard Boone, who was manager of Buzzcocks, had a great idea, which was to reform what were called package shows. And those package shows were very, very popular in the late 50s and early 1960s, where you'd get like 8 acts on the bill and they'd have 15 minutes each and they'd play at your local cinema. Those audiences in 1977 were eager for, let's be blatant, new products. That was why John shared a platform with Buzzcocks.
It gave me 3 warnings, stamped on me toes, stuck his fingers in me eyes, kicked me in the nose, rabbit punch, made me eyes explode, pulled me legs from underneath me, I fell down in the road.
The Manchester music scene was taking shape. Cooper Clarke's mordant observations worked whether he was supporting the pop-punk Buzzcocks, the explosively dramatic Joy Division, or even the insular, sceptical Fall.
I went to the bank just to get a little money.
His special relationship with the Fall's Mark E. Smith has continued on and off since the late 70s.
I ain't got a window and I ain't got a job.
Mate, I got in the office a few times. That's the sort of person he is. He would drop around the office. The guy who was working for me was only ringing girls up on the phone. And he told me that. You want to watch that mic? You know what I mean? So I did. His phone calls coming in from America about deals, and he's ringing up like the girls from Piccadilly Records and writing to him saying things like, you know, you don't want to listen to the Fall, listen to Metallica and stuff like that. No, honestly, yeah. You know what I mean? Something very weird going on there, Mark. That office building, you know. You can't write that, can you? He was right all along.
Hiring Cooper Clarke as warm-up man had its advantages. He'd just turn up, smartly dressed for action, ready for battle, with his trusty exercise book of poems and do his turn. Pete Shelley often shared a bill with John.
No, the whole thing with punk gigs is there's a lot of humour in it. The stage is very small and there wasn't much room to get loads and loads of bands on. Mm. So if you could get somebody who could actually just turn up and do 15, 20 minutes in between the setups, then, you know, you had something which was a cheap and cheerful way.
Yes.
The thing, and, I mean, like John was very cheerful.
This is the sad tale about the dissolution of my previous marriage to a creature from another planet. And we fell in love, but our romance fell victim to intergalactic racialism, ladies and gentlemen, and she had to go home.
The weapon of choice of the punk years, the twopence. The penny, no good. No one really had the financial acumen to be able to sling a tenpence at anyone, which was a much weightier coin. And a 50, let's face it, that's your cab home. And I'd imagine Cooper Clarke, if he just kept the twopences alone that got slung at him.
John's unlikely show business technique could actually tame an unruly punk crowd. Phil Jupiter saw Cooper Clarke for the first time in Chelmsford. Cooper Clarke's belligerent, yet somehow charming carelessness tickled Jupiter's.
There was a perceived coolness that he took away from the gig, and it became entertainment to have as the grout between these tiles of genius. These tired old jokes. And so then the arse says to the barman, but he did them so slowly, he'd almost demand your attention. And in the end, hecklers would just kind of get bored. Mm. It was the laconic, the slowness of delivery. Hello, Chelmsford.
She had a head as big as a TV screen, a glutinous complexion with a day-glow sheen, big bug eyes and a death ray glare.
You have to understand, in the South, we'd seen the comedians and we knew about Bernard, but to actually have one in front of you, he had as much in common with Les Dawson as he did with Patti Smith. That's the weird thing about him. He was a ball of contradictions.
Furnished oxygen tent where a robot chef served up moonbeams.
Playing the punk gigs to both those in favour and those hostile to his appearance and manner had an effect on his performance. The giddy, gung-ho delivery sped up and became a kind of hectic, almost abstract monotone. And more comedy was used to deflect hecklers.
Sex and violence, eh? See, we have a clergyman in the audience.
So I've always mixed it up with gags, and I think now I think there's more kind of in-between stuff. I started writing more crowd-pleasing stuff, yeah. Plus, I speeded it up as well for a lot of years. You know, I used to go at 1,000 miles an hour, you know.
Get letters of lust after immigrants, blood from people in Sunny Mean, in other book. Could you get fairy tales disguises, that facts concerning you, Miskellen, and his stretching his axe?
He saw punk as the next branch of showbiz, I think possibly before any of the other punks did. I think Clarke was the first one that realised this is showbiz just as much as Wilson, Keppel, and Betty were, as Max Wall, Max Miller. Punk is just. This next, it's the entertainment of the people.
On the quiet, behind his ever-present dark glasses, the opaque, elusive Cooper Clarke was a serious student of poetic possibility, of the political power of oral tradition, and a loyal believer in the poet's responsibility to alter consciousness.
The Duke of Edinburgh's threadbare jacket, can't afford the polo, well, not a packet. Margaret Thatcher looks stunning, yes, but why no nipples in the Daily Express? This paper's boring, mindless.
You seem to use humour to smuggle through. Quite sordid, sinister, provocative, challenging ideas.
Possibly, yeah, that has happened, yeah. I can think of a few instances of that, you know. And the stuff I'm writing now is not jokey in any way, you know what I mean? It is poetry, you know. Because there isn't another word for it, really, you know.
It made sense that the Manchester punk scene included a poet. This more literate version of punk was a continuation of the city's radical independent tradition, as if a history that included having the nation's first public library, the launch of the Liberal Guardian newspaper, the invention of the computer, and the establishment of the proudly Northern Granada television was now continuing, with punk labels, groups and clubs.
The scene in Manchester wasn't so much about the music, it was about everything else. I mean, you yourself were part of the of what made the Manchester scene. There was no, like, clothes designers involved in punk in Manchester. So it became first about things like William Burroughs. No, so it became something which has had some kind of literary appeal to it.
Cooper Clarke had found a place because of punk's fundamental open-mindedness, but as C.P. Lee acknowledges, his character, his fastidious, illuminating northern smartness, his nimble survival instincts, the crooked romanticism, are rooted in a whole century of very much Salford intellectual, literary and political adventure.
There was a place called the Salford Workers' Arts Club on Weest, and people like Ewan McCall would hang out there. It had a library and it had a concert room, and that's where people who were denied grammar school education because they couldn't afford it or their parents couldn't afford to send them to grammar school would educate themselves. And it was an idea, not just in Salford, but all around the world, that if you could learn books, then you had knowledge, and knowledge is power.
You could sense that the earthlings would not understand. They would nudge, nudge when we got on the bus saying it's extraterrestrial, not like us. It's bad enough with another race, but...
And through that came, I think, a lot of John's use of words and flights of fancy with words. And a great deal of his power is evoked from that great well of socialist working class principles of the 1930s.
Make a date with the slaughtering brides of Britain. They all together do to read his wives, who lay down their needles and their knitting at the doorway to our dismal daily lives.
John now lives in Colchester, and revisiting a modernised Manchester, he remembers a different town and a varied working life that helped inspire his poetry.
My old school, the place where I grew up, even the place where my mother was rehoused after our old place was knocked down. So I'm into two generations of architectural demolition here. You know, so everything I knew has been knocked down twice.
What about some of the places you would have played within sort of reach of here? You know, can you mark them out, where they would have been?
Yeah, a little bit further up the road to our right, as we stand looking out at the Free Trade Hall, would have been Rafters.
Yes. Band on the Wall, that's what
Band on the Wall, which was to the north of here, in what's called Ancoats, the area of Ancoats, which has traditionally been the Italian quarter of Manchester, in which I was employed. I was actually used to work in a firm opposite the Band on the Wall called the Friedlander Brothers, and they used to make foam back coats for women.
Could you give us an official list of your ex-jobs? Because I've never quite pinned
them
down.
How long have you got?
Oh, go on, do it.
How long have you got? At a window cleaning round for a while with my cousin Sid. I was an apprentice motor mechanic and a compositor back in the days of lead type. At that point, the job hadn't changed since the days of William Caxton.
The free-thinking Manchester minds of the time aggressively demonstrated their love of language, their intellectual curiosity and their desire to prove that the everyday North wasn't on the drab, foggy outskirts of the universe, but at the living, picturesque centre.
You know what I say, what I mean. I say what comes to my mind. You see, I never get around to things.
Kind of about the surface of things, I think. Which isn't to say it's superficial in itself, you know what I mean? But it does deal with, you know, the patina of life. Rather than I'll tell you why that is, you know, it's just sort of I'll tell you what is. You know, what is it, finding the universal in the particular, hopefully. It's a tough call, that, though, isn't it?
Outside the takeaway Saturday night, a bald adolescent offered me a fight, gave my face a millimetre tread, stole me chop suey and left me for dead.
Because he just can't help it, strange things tend to happen to Cooper Clarke. And one of the strangest was the fact that by the end of the 70s, he was signed to the mighty London-based CBS Records, which made him a label mate of Meatloaf and Judas Priest. CBS were looking for a Northern Ian Drury, some commercially eccentric novelty entertainment, and they got experimental Manchester mischief instead. Pioneering psychedelic Manchester producer Martin Hannett backed Cooper Clarke's oddly dignified poker-faced phrasing with a dreamy punk jazz incidental music.
Weddings and funerals, special occasions, and all the usual distant relations.
What are your memories about how that happened, that you started to actually make records as a poet, which was a really unusual kind of thing to do, although John Betjeman, oddly enough, had made some wonderful records on Charisma.
Don't really remember too much about it. That is a long time ago, and I don't think they captured the magic fully, the records.
Cooper Clarke had smuggled himself out of the folk clubs into the centre of one of the most exciting music scenes in the world. But as he said at the time, one thing leads to another. And in his case, this meant an implausible, pretty chilling relationship based around shared heroin addiction with the wandering Velvet Underground singer and iconic Warhol darling, Nico.
And all the times I hate.
Even Marquis Smith was slightly taken aback.
I remember when Nico was there and it was a bit weird walking down Prestwick Street to see Nico in a shop, you know, but she was staying with him in his flat.
In John's mind, it made sense to follow up Living at the Edge of Reason with Nico by hanging out in crackpot TV commercials for Sugar Puffs with the Honey Monster.
It's tummy time.
Love my honey.
This is the first tummy time commercial in which Johnny Clark and Honey Monster will be demonstrating how fabulous Sugar Puffs are.
Monsterific.
Funny thing about the '80s for me with you, John, is that the two things that happened that have been boiled down to be the sound bites, almost like you were writing a piece of fiction that you made real, that it would be Nico and Sugar Puffs Honey Monster.
They sound like two fulfilled ambitions, don't they? But I just got lucky in both cases, I'm afraid.
Let's go and make a pudding with them in the studio kitchen.
Rolling.
Andy Warhol would have understood. He wouldn't have seen any conflict there.
In the 1980s, punk was the past, and as the punk poet, he was now officially out of time. His reaction was to stick to his mad mod speed-reading guns, and the fashions of the time, the shoulder pads and the shiny new romantics, weren't going to change his mind.
This disc concerns those pouting prima donnas found within the swelling J. Arthur ranks of the sex...
The purest poetry establishment viewed him, if at all, with suspicion. His nefarious mixing with the music world, the bloody sunglasses and the hipster uniform meant he was not as such a poet, but a sort of debauched comedian, and there were still no published Cooper Clarke books. Jules Denby, one of the UK's first female performance poets, was inspired to write and perform by John Cooper Clarke.
What people forget about John is they see the quirky image, which he's kept, and they see the funniness. What they're not seeing is the brilliant use of language. And that, I think, is something which is a great shame. And John has written some excoriatingly brilliant pieces of serious poetry. I mean, Beasley Street is a masterpiece.
She was more of a man than he'll ever be, the one he couldn't beat. A messy job, leave it to me, I tear up Beasley Street, it just isn't what it isn't.
That is not appreciated by, you know, the literary establishment, who like to view anybody who has the ability to perform their poetry, or just basically read their poetry aloud really well, as second rate.
In recent years, now that post-punk sound and idealism has entered the mainstream, a new generation of fans rediscovered him as a kind of shadowy lost legend. He's been a mentor to literate, facetious Sheffield popsters Arctic Monkeys. An early rumour was that Cooper Clarke actually wrote their lyrics, and they print his poems on the album sleeves.
Last night these two bouncers, and one of them's alright, the other one's a scary, and his way or no way, totalitarian, he's got no...
He's also influenced fellow Sheffield group The Reverend and the Makers, who recorded a track with him. John McClure is lead singer in the band.
Edgy Clissville, terraced houses, Lilo Lills, unfaithful spouses, dirty weekends by the sea and stains on sheets in B&Bs.
The rain whips the promenade, it drips on ships, they turn to lard. I'd send a card if I had a pen. I mustn't go down to the sea again.
I think our generation, there's a lot of hip-hop, isn't there, and rap and stuff like that, and things of, like, with any, like, lyrical content seem to have evaporated in some way, and then people started to search for a bit of a meaning in the word. You link to things, don't you, and trace things back, and all roads seem to lead to Johnny Clarke, where I were looking. It's like, when I listen to him, what he's talking about, it's like, that's my life, that's the people I know.
Cooper Clarke has toured Australia with Lily Allen. He's definitely a gabby godfather to Lily and her way of chatting up an audience using personal experience and vigilant humour.
Sometimes I find myself sitting back and reminiscing, especially when I have to watch other people kissing, and I remember when...
My dad introduced me to him years ago and I was quite scared of him. He's quite a funny looking character. And then I did a gig with Joe Strummer at the LA2 for like some sort of poetry week or something, and me and Joe sang together and he introed the night. I think he's really funny, you know, that whole kind of Manchester scene is, well, he's such an integral part of a lot of sort of poetry, I suppose, modern culture. Yeah, I just think he's a great guy, he's very clever and very intelligent.
The ultimate confirmation of John Cooper Clarke as timeless British classic, as original otherworldly mind, was when his poem Evidently Chicken Town turned up in an episode of the modern mob classic The Sopranos. Don Letts again.
I remember hearing Evidently Chicken Town in one of the episodes of Sopranos and having an immense sense of pride, and I wasn't quite sure why I had that pride, but it was great to know that, you know, this poetry, music, whatever you want to call it, connected with these people. They thought it worthwhile to stick in their soundtrack, because everything in The Sopranos, you know, has been thought about. I think that Sopranos thing was a moment of crowning glory and recognition that he was bigger than the Manchester phenomenon. Evidently chicken
sound. Cooper Clarke is still not a published poet, but he's reclaimed his role as dazed, dazzling, psyched-up court jester to those who like having him around to liven up their own shows. He'll support the new band of the Clash's Mick Jones, Silicon Carbon. He'll appear before Damon Albarn's The Good, The Bad and The Queen. And to this day, there is no better support act for The Fall.
Medically, for the Nobel Prize, I mean, that's the country we live in, Paul.
But you think he deserves to be given?
Of course I do. Yeah, he should be the poet laureate, shouldn't he? I mean, if I would say that, I'm not just saying it.
John Cooper Clarke is loved and wanted again. But he's always on his toes, ready for the moment he once more slips or is pushed out of fashion, back into the shadows. Sometimes he seems to orchestrate his own disappearing act, just in case too much time in the limelight might spoil his mind, ruin his timing, blur his vision, and bring him down to ordinary, explainable earth alongside the rest of us.
You can't really prepare for any of it. That's why people who go, get famous go cracking. And if you are prepared for it, you must be some kind of monster. You know what I mean? Oh, yes. There must be a voice in your head. Oh, yes, I deserve this.
Why is there an unbelievable tradition of pulling yourself apart at the moment of when you might just be thinking I might have pulled something off? Is that something that's part of your character in a way?
What do I do that?
Self-deprecation.
Do I do that then?
You do an awful lot of it, John.
Really? Yeah. I always thought I'd big myself up to some degree. Really? I'm funny, isn't it? You know, I had an idea I was a right big-headed, so... I don't know, it's manners or something, I don't know.
Our days were numbered and the nights were spent in a rent-free furnished oxygen tent where a robot chef served up moonbeams.
How would I like to be remembered? Remember me as a good thing. Who said that? Diana Ross? I can't argue with that.
You're a missing link between Diana Ross and Charles Baudelaire.
You're right. Go on then. But Paul, where did our love go? Please. Stop, in the name of love. That could be the last line, couldn't it?
Next time I see a translucent face, I remember it from outer space, ta. Thank you.
The Bard of Salford was presented by Paul Morley. The producer was Elizabeth Olker, and it was an all-out production for BBC Radio 4. After the news, you and yours will report on the insurance scam to pretend 16 passengers had been injured in a bus crash. Well, looking ahead, in 2006, Marsden Heights Community College in Lancashire opened as part of a radical reorganisation of local schools. It was designed to improve performance and help integrate the white and Asian populations in the area. Almost 2 years on, BBC Radio 4 has visited the college to find out how close it is to achieving its goals.
I've had several conversations with parents who are considering taking their children out. Undoubtedly, the danger is that we would then be perceived as being the Asian school.
Divided Britain Teaching Tolerance is next Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock.